In view of yesterday and last night's tragic events in Paris, probably over, at this point, over 150 people killed, I'm understanding, senselessly, by what is apparently a small band of jihadists. Our hearts go out to the citizens, families of that city in anguish over violence, the loss, the disruption to the peaceful lives that we and they all desire. Many people were stranded in the wake of the attack. People who had no place to go, public transportation was halted. People were wandering in the streets. Many residents opened their homes to those who were stranded. And a beautiful demonstration of compassion and hospitality that comes from a different place than that of the jihadists. There will be a couple of reactions among the nations who are witnessing this atrocity. The first reaction will be to draw the conclusion that no one is safe. All of us in every city are subject to sudden violence and death. The second reaction, and it's already coming, is that somehow Jews are responsible. I saw one article in which a Palestinian activist is pointing out that Bibi Netanyahu has been upset by recent events in Europe, where they've begun to label Israeli-made goods in order to make them a better target for the BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the State of Israel. So in other words, Bibi had a motive to harm Europe, and he may have been behind what took place. That was the accusation. It's also known that the Bataclan, the name of the nightclub or concert hall, I guess, is owned by Jewish owners, and the location has been a place of controversy for several years as they cater to Jewish performers and Jewish audiences, all audiences, but they also cater to Jewish audiences. So the subtle message is that as long as there are Jews in our midst, we are vulnerable to sudden retaliation in the form of terrorist violence. I remember a family many years ago. They're not around anymore, but they asked that their names not be included in our members' directory. They said it was because they believed that the persecution of Jews would return, even in America, and anyone who is connected with Jews will receive the persecution that the Jews receive. They didn't want their family exposed unnecessarily to that kind of fate. They figured that the directory could fall into the hands of the wrong people and with dire consequences. Okay, they're not around anymore. I also remember a question being asked of me by another family. We were talking about Jewish conversion, and they asked, if they come after Jews again, as in the Holocaust, what's to stop the convert from renouncing his conversion and declaring himself to be not a Jew? So there's a question there of trust or mistrust towards those who are converted or who have aligned themselves with the Jewish people but could get out of it if the persecution comes back. I believe that the escalating violence in the world will challenge everyone who declares himself or herself to be a friend of the Jews. Will you still be a friend when they come for you? Today's Torah portion has some bearing on this question. It is purportedly about the generation of Isaac, Toldot, which means generations, the generations of Yitzchak. And the title of my message is The God of Isaac, or the God of Yitzchak, however you want to say it. But Isaac himself is not very active in this parsha. You see more about Rivka giving birth to twins, Esav and Yaakov, or Esau and Jacob. The selling of the birthright, the description of Isaac by Jacob, and the deception of Isaac by Jacob. Jacob deceived his father Isaac, and then Jacob's departure to get away from Esau. So stuck in the middle of all of this drama about Esau and Jacob and family, there's this family vacation to Gerar. Well, not a family vacation, I'm just kidding. It was a famine. And to escape the famine, Yitzchak, or Isaac, took his little family to Gerar. And there, the king, this is a Philistine city, the king was Abimelech, or Abimelech, as some people say, was the king of the Philistines. And a scene transpires reminiscent of Abraham and Sarah. Isaac declares that Rivka is his sister, so that the people wouldn't kill him in order to get Rivka. Does that sound familiar? I'm sure Abimelech must have drawn a connection in his own mind to Abraham and Sarah. It couldn't have been that forgettable since the incidents were so similar. Anyway, once the ruse was discovered and Abimelech shows himself to be a gentleman, he restores Rivka to Isaac and instructs his own people not to touch either of them under penalty of death. That was a very powerful statement that Abimelech did. I think it was a very good thing. So then, Isaac prospers in Gerar and he expands his home and his possessions. The Philistines become envious. And they stopped up the wells. See, they had stopped up the wells that had been dug by Abraham. After Abraham left, they had stopped up the wells, filling them with earth. And Abimelech tells Isaac he has to leave because Isaac had become mightier than the Philistines. So they were a threat to them. Now, I want to pause here just to ask a question. Has your success ever been viewed as a threat by others? Not only are people jealous of other people's success, but they see that success as power. They fear that it could be used against those who are less successful. This is a very similar thing that was happening with Isaac. So Isaac moved to the valley. He began to redig the wells that were there, wells that his father Abraham had previously dug. He called the wells by the names that Abraham had called them. Now, one of the wells began to flow with water, and it became contested. The herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, claiming that the water belonged to them. So Isaac named that well Esek, quarrel, moved to another location. And that well became successful, and the herdsmen quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen about that well. And Isaac named that well Sitna, or hatred, and moved on again. This time, Isaac dug a successful well, and the locals did not quarrel. So he named it Rehovot, or enlarge. And this time, Isaac didn't stay there. He left again and went to Beersheba, the well of promise. See, that's when Abimelech shows up again. And he asked Isaac an interesting question. Actually, Isaac asked him an interesting question. He says to Abimelech, "Why have you come to me since you hate me and you sent me away from you?" This is Isaac asking Abimelech, "Why have you come to me since you hate me?" It's a good question. After all, he sent them away. Why should he come back? And Abimelech said, "We have seen that the Lord is with you." He wanted to make a covenant with Isaac based on seeing that the Lord was with him. He wanted Isaac to promise not to harm them. And he said, "Since we have not touched you, and since we have done nothing to you but good, and have sent you away in peace." Well, that's a stretch. But they had a feast, they ate and drank together, they made an oath with each other, and departed in peace. Now, after this, the story goes on with Esau taking a wife from among the Hittites, which became a grief of mind to both Isaac and Rivka. And so this part of the parasha is the only part where Isaac is particularly active. There might be more we could say about Isaac's love for Esau, his desire to bless him despite the ways Esau had grieved him. There are commentaries describing Isaac's psychological condition, having been offered on the altar, nearly killed. He was bound and placed on the altar, and it looked like his father was going to cut his throat. That's pretty traumatic, potentially. Having seen his half-brother alienated from the family, sent away, there are some midrashim that even contend that Isaac worked to bring reconciliation between Abraham and Ishmael, being motivated to show a special kind of love through that to Esau. In other words, Esau, who was a grief of mind in some ways to Isaac, Isaac wanted to show a special kind of love because he saw what happened when his half-brother was alienated. He didn't want to alienate him. He didn't want to see that kind of rift. He wanted to see it healed. So anyway, this story with the wells in Gerar is the one story that focuses entirely on Isaac and his actions. So I'm going to focus on what's taking place in that part of the story as we talk about the God of Isaac. At the beginning of the story, Isaac is apparently intent on going to Egypt. We see this because Adonai appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt." I'm going to read this passage from Genesis 26. "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my Torot, my laws, my Torah." In several recent issues of the Messiah Journal, how many people get the Messiah Journal? Ever heard of it? You might not get it or might not remember it by that name. It's the publication of the First Fruits of Zion. It's one that comes out with scholarly articles in it. There's a series of articles by Carl Kimbar writing about the promises to the patriarchs. He's expanding on a verse from Romans 15, verses 8 and 9, which read as follows. "Now I say that Yeshua Messiah has become a servant to the circumcision for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made to the fathers, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written." In these articles, he expands on this idea that Messiah has become a servant to the circumcision to confirm the promises to the fathers. So there's some connection in which Yeshua became the one who has somehow delivered these promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, the fathers of the Jewish people, that somehow these promises are now being delivered through the actions of Yeshua. The Yeshua is somehow the one who is the servant to the circumcision to confirm the promises. He describes the promise to Abraham. This is Carl Kinbar, Dr. Carl Kinbar, describing the promises to Abraham on the condition of obedience and the sacrifice of Isaac. That was Abraham's debt or his requirement in order to receive the promises that were given to him. He describes the promise to Jacob as being unconditional, but showing that wrestling that has to take place as Jacob comes to grips with the consequences of being the chosen seed. So in other words, the promises are unconditional, but he still wrestles with God. He still struggles with believing that the promises are real. And so that's an interesting message about Jacob. But the promise to Isaac is very different from either of those two. It is conditioned on remaining in the land. The land that was promised to him and to his father Abraham and later to Jacob. He was the only patriarch that was not allowed to leave the land that was promised throughout his days. And even though the land had been promised to him, he had not yet been permitted to take possession of it. He still lived in it as a stranger, a sojourner. Still, his assignment was to stay in the land as a sojourner. And on that basis, he would receive the promises. His descendants would one day take possession of it. Now, when Isaac was in Gerar, the Lord prospered him, and he sowed in the land. He reaped a hundredfold that same year that he sowed. A hundredfold he received. He continued to prosper with flocks and with herds and with a great number of servants. Abimelech said that Isaac was much mightier than the Philistines in that place. When Abimelech sent Isaac away, what was Isaac's response? I bet he could have thought to himself, "My God, the God of my father Abraham has promised to give this land to me and my descendants. Perhaps it's time for me to let these folks know whom they are dealing with." He could have fought them. He possibly could have conquered them and possessed the land. Instead, he packed up his tents and his people and his goods. He left the fields that he had planted and he moved to the valley. He chose to keep the peace, despite being judged unfairly as a threat to the occupants of the land. When he dug wells and the wells prospered, the people let him know that they didn't want him and his flocks and herd and servants to live among them, taking their water. They didn't want them prospering there among them. They based their claim on the right to the wells that were dug in that area. Isaac could have fought them. He probably could have won. Instead, he moved on again and again. When Isaac finally found his place, a place where the people were not contending with him, Abimelech shows up. He wants to make peace. What inspired Abimelech to do this? It wasn't a visitation from God. It wasn't like Joseph, when Miriam turned up pregnant and an angel came to Joseph and said, "I did that." I mean, if it hadn't been an angel telling him that, he wouldn't have believed anything, I'm sure. But it wasn't like that with Abimelech. It wasn't a visitation from God. No, Abimelech said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." What did Abimelech see? First, he saw that Isaac's crops were abundant. He saw that his herds, his flocks, his servants were abundant. Did that convince Abimelech that the Lord was with Isaac? No, it did not. It only convinced him that Isaac had become a threat. First, he saw that Isaac respected his authority as a king. As king, Abimelech asked Isaac to go away. When Isaac first arrived, Abimelech used his authority to protect Isaac and Rivka. The Philistine immigration policy protected immigrants from rape and murder, apparently. He was protecting Isaac and Rivka from rape and murder. It didn't protect them, however, from their own prosperity. Once they became a threat, the Philistine version of ICE came along, and told them they had to leave. That's the Immigration Customs and Enforcement. And they left. Now, I'm sure Abimelech was relieved when they left. They weren't going to have to fight Isaac and all those numbers of people. So when Isaac began to unclog the wells of his father, the locals were still suspicious. They probably had some of the same concerns that Abimelech had. These people come, they dig wells, they water their flocks, they expand, while we, meanwhile, sit by and watch them prosper. This isn't going to work. We have to get rid of them. Isaac might have thought to himself, who do these people think they are? Here we are, digging wells that were blocked up after Abraham, my father, departed from the area. He dug the wells, and they weren't using these wells. How can they lay claim to them now? They have no right. Perhaps I should show them whom they are dealing with. But instead, he left. Twice. So what did Abimelech see? He saw the God of Abraham expressed in humility and peace. Isaac was caught between a rock and a hard place. He couldn't just leave and go down to Egypt. God had already warned him not to do that. He couldn't go back to Be'er Lachai Roi, which means the well of him that lives and sees me, which is where he was living when there was a famine. He couldn't go back there because of the famine. He chose to depart, but he didn't go far. Even there, he had to leave again and again. He chose to abandon any future claim or right to be in that place. He chose not to stand and fight. He chose to dwell in peace wherever he could find it. This is the God of Isaac, whom Abimelech saw when he said, "The Lord is with you." Isaac's test and his testimony was that he also obeyed the voice of God. He also did not depart from the land. He sought to remain there and to dwell in peace. Today, when someone comes to me as an elder in Ohev, and they say that God has called them to be a prophet or a minister or an evangelist of some kind, whatever, when someone claims to be something, I look to see whether there is a testimony in that person of the God of Isaac. Every calling and every gift will be tested. And when the person comes through that test, they will have a testimony. But the testimony I'm looking for is not that they survived the test. Rather, I want to see the humility and that love for peace, that shalom, not just the lack of conflict, but a hunger for that lasting, fulfilling, unrestrained peace that doesn't fear. We don't see this much in the world today. Page 6. Last page. Today we see everyone fighting for their own rights, the right to be respected, the right to be whatever they choose to be. Starbucks changes the design of their cups and Christians are offended. Cartoonist draws a caricature of Muhammad and the jihadists wipe out the staff of the publication. But Isaac, who probably knew that Esau was not acting like the child of promise, marrying the wrong kind of girls, living as a hunter, rather than a contemplative shepherd, the one you'd want to give the promise to. And yet he loved Esau unconditionally, wanting to bless him, wanting to keep him in the loop, rather than to isolate him or to chastise him. God had other plans, but Isaac wanted peace in his home. He knew the way of humility and the way of peace. And ultimately, after everything, even after his death, Esau and Jacob were able to reconcile in peace. Yeshua has become a servant to the circumcision to confirm the promises to the fathers. Why do we need that? Because our enemy goes about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. We put our trust in the God of Isaac, who has taught us the way of humility and the way of peace. This is the spirit of Yeshua. It is our own key to inheriting the promises. That we might dwell in the land of promise unceasingly and with humility and in peace. This is through Yeshua, the one who confirms that promise to the circumcision, the Jewish people, the land of Israel, the hope of Israel, Yeshua, the personal embodiment of the God of Isaac. Amen. Elders, please come.